Welcome to our Goals to Podcasts, where we take you behind the scenes with authors of many different writing styles. I'm Lucinda Hawksley, and today we're looking at the art of novel writing. I hope you enjoy this episode. If you want to find out more, go to www.goldster.co.uk and don't forget to subscribe to the podcast. Hello, everybody, and welcome to Goldster Inside Story. Today, I'm absolutely thrilled to be joined by Jessica Fellows. First time I met Jessica was a few years ago. We were both doing the same literary festival, and she was talking about her books on Downton Abbey. And since then, she has become an amazing crime writer, and she's now got a standalone novel. So she really does kind of go across the spectrum of non-fiction and fiction. So welcome, Jessica. Thank you so much for joining us.
I'm really happy to be here. Thank you.
So it's lovely to see how many, you've just had deadline after deadline. You must be absolutely exhausted.
I have to admit, I did get to a point of burnout, I think, about April this year. And I realised that I'd written a book a year, sometimes a bit more, since 2010. And a mixture of non-fiction and fiction. But I think, funny enough, it's just so many of us, you know, I think we've got ourselves through the lockdowns and the pandemics, and then kind of having got through that is when you suddenly go, oh my God, I'm such a knackered. And I knew I was just finishing, I just finished earlier this year, the last of my series of six books, The Mitford Secret. And I think it was that, you know, it was just that real push to get over the final hurdle. And so now that I'm here, it's really nice. I mean, in some ways, I've been really sort of anticipating with a bit of fear getting into a period of no deadline. And I'm sort of almost officially unemployed, really. But
it's scary. It's a scary time, I know.
It's a bit scary. The next one, yeah, it doesn't really help with the apocalyptic headlines and things going on at the same time. But I'm enjoying. I'm going to have a little bit of time. There are a couple of projects that I'm thinking about doing, and I'm enjoying a little bit of space in which to think about that. Normally I'm doing creative thinking under the pressure of a deadline, and so it's quite nice to see what happens when my mind can unspool a bit, although I have a feeling that I'll want to get a deadline again quite soon. I think I've just, you know, it gives me a rhythm and a structure to my life. Yeah. I actually quite like, probably.
And there is a real buzz when you're writing and you've got that deadline, and it is a wonderful feeling.
But it is really nice. Yeah.
It's good to have that space in between as well, as you say, to let your mind come up with other ideas.
Because yeah, but I mean, I've been very lucky. I can do, because I did journalism for quite a long time, I still do little bits and pieces of it, not much. But if I get asked to do something, and my favourite is, you know, we've had an idea in conference this morning and we need it by 3 o'clock this afternoon. You just go, what? Yes. 2,000 words and kind of get it done. And that's really, you know, and that's really nice. Not sustainable on a daily basis for me anymore, anyway, with fiction. But it's nice to know, to prove to yourself that you can just, you know, it's that kind of very tangible sense of getting something finished is nice, you know. And I think particularly for fiction writers, because it's quite hard to say, that's it, I'm now, you know, it's now over. You keep wanting to go back to it. And so that kind of non-fiction finish is really nice.
But tell us about when you first fell in love with writing. Did you always want to be a writer? Were you an avid reader as a child, or was it something that just happened because you kind of fell into writing?
No, I was an avid reader, and I was an avid reader, I think, partly because I'm deaf. So I wear hearing aids. My hearing loss is somewhere between 40 and 80%, depending on pitch, without my aids in. And when I was younger, the hearing aids were pretty useless. They were analogue aids, and I used to have to wear some loop and a box around my neck and things. And then that got a bit better behind the ear hearing aids. So I was always fine. I was always able to kind of participate in life, but it was knackering. And so I think it was just really, I just really enjoy sitting on the sofa and reading a book for hours. And of course, there weren't all the distractions that there are now. So I was always a very avid reader, but I didn't, funny enough, didn't particularly translate that into being a writer. I used to make a lot of radio shows. That was what I really wanted to do. I used to pretend I was a radio host. And I sort of wanted to be a barrister for a very long time, which was mainly because there was some BBC drama on with a very glamorous barrister with red lipstick, and I thought it looked cool. And then somebody explained how much work you have to do to get a legal degree. And I did a philosophy degree, which was great, but fairly useless in terms of pointing me in any direction. I still came to London and I just didn't really know what I was going to do, sort of flailing about a bit. And then I was incredibly lucky. My mother's best friend lived next door to an editor at the Mail on Sunday. And she said, look, I'll give you a job for 6 months. It will look good on your CV. And so I went in at your absolute lowest grade dog's body. And I sort of ended up there pretty much for 6 years. And in that time, I got the opportunity to write a couple of things. She didn't always publish everything that I wrote, but she was quite encouraging about, you know, one or two things. And I started thinking, what I hadn't thought I wanted to be a journalist because I didn't think I would like any of that doorstepping element. But because what grew in that time, so I finished university in 98, that's when I went to work at the Mail on Sunday, that was the real growth of features and lifestyle and all of that. And so I was like, oh, that's quite appealing. And I liked the collaborative element of that. And so that was what got me into writing. So I really, really came to it very late, you know, and didn't even really think. I always thought I'd be 40 when I wrote my first novel. And I sort of was about that in the end.
Yeah. And so who were the writers that you read when you were younger? Who were the people who were inspiring you?
Oh, it's very eclectic mix. Funny enough, I know, because I've kept this little notebook since I was 16 of every book I've ever read.
Oh, wow, fantastic.
And of course, the appalling thing is I read really good books when I was younger, and it just gets worse and worse and, you know, and less.
Mine would be exactly the same. I was so much more high-minded when I was younger than I am now.
So it was always very eclectic mix, but I did quite early on, I would say when I was about 18-19, I really got into the Between the Wars authors, and I read a lot of Scott Fitzgerald, Evelyn Waugh, Dorothy Parker, Graham Greene, you know, all that lot really, and Somerset Maugham. He was a big favourite of mine. And that really stemmed from the fact that I was very close to my uncle Julian, who was the one who wrote Downton Abbey. And we used to go, he was quite a young uncle when I was little. I didn't get married until I was about 16. And he used to take me on holidays with him, stay with friends of his who have families. And we would have this quite a lot of time to talk together. And he used to tell me about all the funny family stories from that era and that kind of life. You know, his own father, was born in 1912, my grandfather, who I knew, and he had memories of when the war began and his father was killed in the war and how that affected his mother and how their life changed. And we had all this kind of the crazy ancestor called Daisy Fellows, who was famous for being incredibly naughty and wearing see-through dresses. My mother had one of her dresses. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of it was a very glamorous and connected time in a way. But also I loved that kind of intensity of that period. So that all really began then with those authors. So it's been a sort of the fact that my career has ended up following along those lines, you know, it's not planned at all, but it definitely stems from that.
So when was the first time you were commissioned to write a book as opposed to an article?
Basically what happened was I was at Country Life magazine. I was deputy editor of Country Life magazine from 2004 for about 4 years. And when I was there, I started writing a series of columns for the now defunct The London paper. And I did a Friday column for them about a townie's guide to country weekends. Because I was a complete townie. I grew up in London and, you know, it was always a massive shock to all my friends that I went to work for Country Life magazine. I knew nothing about the country. Anyway. So I wrote this kind of series of columns, and then somebody commissioned me to turn those into a book. So that was my first book. And then I left Country Life in 2008. And so I'd left in 2008, and then 6 months later was when we had the Lehman's crash, and the whole world kind of collapsed in on itself. And I had about 6 to 8 months of good commissions, and then everything, just all the money started to run out, and journalism just starts to get harder and harder. And yet they have more and more content to fill because it was expanding onto internet and so on. So I just remember the nadir was just being asked to write about the high street's 10 best sandwiches. And I thought, I mean, I can't do this for the next 40 years. This is, you know, how it's going to go. I thought it would get more and more interesting, more and more in depth, and it's just not going to do that. So I thought, I'm going to have to, you know, start thinking of something else to do. And I just thought with books, I thought, well, I could challenge myself to just do a long form version of what I do anyway. And I thought, if I keep maintain my journalism discipline, which is just you show up at your desk every day, you know, maybe I'll be able to do that. So I got myself an agent, a young agent who was kind of building a client list, and she got me my first book. So I had to kind of audition for it, as it were. But so I was up against a couple of other writers and I got it, and it was to do a book on how to spot psychopaths working with a forensic psychology.
I was fascinated. Tell us about that one. That's extraordinary.
I know. So it was brilliant. She was the most amazing woman, actually, Kerry Danes. And she, in fact, she does quite a bit on TV and stuff now. She's a very glamorous kind of Mancunian. And she'd worked with some of the most high profile criminals in the country. And she specialised really in sexual crimes and crimes against children. And so she said, the thing is, it's incredibly distressing work. And so she said, I can't sustain it. You know, she said she looks at these incredibly distressing images all day for her court work. Yeah. And then I'd have to go and have drinks with friends in the evening, you know, so it was done to kind of fire her mind. So she was looking to kind of get out of it and start writing. And so she had identified this area of psychopathy, which is sort of not the extreme killers. There's something called a psychopathy score by Robert Hare. It's between 0 and 30. It's a series of questions, and you score 0, 1, or 2 for each question. And most of us on that score would come out with maybe 2 or 3 points. And someone like your sort of Harold Shipman or whatever would score, you know, maybe it's 40 points, I can't remember. They would be the high end, like 25 to 30, say. But she said there's this little lot of people who sit around sort of 16 to 17 points, and you don't find them in prison. You find them usually at very high level corporate jobs. And they are the kind of people who would sort of sell their grandmother, you know, to do anything. So they're not killers, but they're extremely nasty people to be around. Mm-hmm. And dangerous to be married to and dangerous to work with and all that. In fact, one of the jobs that she now does is identifying potential psychopaths at interviews for people who come in to work for kind of hedge fund thing. You said it's really interesting because, you know, they don't want real psychopaths, but they do like a little bit.
A slight tendency to
be. Because they want someone. Wow. They want someone who's got that kind of single-minded drive, you know. So it was absolutely fascinating. That was actually worked really well as a transition from journalism, because it really was a series of interviews with her and writing them up. And then I really liked the challenge of writing them into her voice.
Yeah.
And I learned a lot about psychopathy. The only slight thing about it was I was pregnant at the time and I was writing it. And I remember going, I didn't do any kind of antenatal classes or whatever, but I did one yoga pregnancy thing. And I was sitting around in this circle and the teacher was saying, oh, so everybody tell us, you know, what you do. And the person before me said, oh, I'm doing an art history degree at the moment. And the teacher said, oh, that's how marvellous, you know, so you must be, as your child is growing inside you, you're looking at all these beautiful paintings. And I thought, oh my God, I'm reading about psychopaths. And what is that doing?
Did you get totally terrified about what was going
on? Did you get a bit terrified? Yeah. Anyway, but anyway, I did that. And then after I got that, it kind of came in a bit of a rush. Basically, that summer 2010, my son was born. So I'd only really just finished the psychopathy book. I think maybe it came out in 2009, I can't remember. And then I was meant to take a bit of a break, but maternity leave, but I sort of didn't really. 2010 was the year that the first Downton Abbey series came out.
Yeah.
And I ended up, I'd gone for an interview to write two business books, a business book, became two business books for the founders of notonthehighstreet.com. And I got that. And then at the same time, my agent said, I've heard that the producers of Downton, you know, are publishing a book, but they haven't found a writer. Do you think we should put you forward for it? So I emailed Julian and said, would you mind if there was another fellows on the project, what do you think? And he said, yeah, I think it's a great idea. So I ended up meeting the publishers. They really liked the fact that I'd worked at Country Life magazine, so I knew my houses. I had a very natural instinct for that kind of between the wars era because of my love for all those authors. And you know, there was no sort of academic knowledge particularly, but there was a real enthusiasm. And I was really interested in the project because it was not just how the series was made, but it was about the social history context, the real life inspiration behind the plots and the characters and so on. So I ended up writing that in January 2011 in order to get it out in time for the second series in 2011. But I thought it would just be the one book, you know, and I can remember being a bit, first I was a bit unenthusiastic. My boy was 4 or 5 months old and I kind of wanted to sit at home a bit. My husband was like, no, if you don't, this is going to lead to so many amazing things, you've got to do it. And actually it worked very well because he's, you know, they sleep most of the time, and I just would write when he napped. And
quite idyllic, sounds rather a lovely thing to
have done. It was a nice thing. And it was nice to kind of be thinking about nice things after psychopaths.
Absolutely. From psychopaths to country houses. You see, that could be your memoir name.
Well, that pretty much took me on to Mitford Murders. I mean, in the end, that was there.
Well, let's talk about Mitford Murders. So you were writing non-fiction, you've done journalism and non-fiction, but did you always know you wanted to write a novel? Or
I think any writer thinks, you know, there must be a novel in me somewhere. But I ended up, Downton Abbey books kind of kept on going, you know, every year I think this will be the last one and then there'd be another. So I ended up doing, I think, 5 or 6 altogether. One was a sort of quite small one, in quotations. But I was sort of, you know, was thinking, I'd do novel. And so finished the Downton, and they said, that really is it. There really won't be any more TV. So I knew the books were definitely over. I'd had 1 year off because I had to get the business books done in between. And then I thought, okay, now maybe now's the time to do fiction. And I thought, well, I knew I would want to do something that was set in that Between the Wars era. It just made sense. I'd done so much research doing the Downton books. And I felt there was still a lot more to say about that era. Really find it, you know, a very fascinating time. Yeah. So I knew I would do that anyway. I started writing a novel and sort of showed it to a few people. And they were, you know, they was like, well, maybe you do this and do this. And I got a new agent off the back of it. And then I just had the extraordinary good luck that I was approached by Ed Wood, who is my publisher at Little Brown, and he had come up with the concept of the Mitford Murders as a series. So he knew, you know, the idea of taking all 6 sisters and using each one as a, you know, each book in the series and putting them into sort of fictional crime situations. Anyway, he came, we had a meeting, he said, what do you think? And I said, no, it sounds, you know, probably amazing, let me go away and think about it. And my feeling was that the Mitford sisters themselves were not really likable enough to carry readers through for a whole series. You're not going to root for them.
Yeah.
But they're fascinating. But once I came up with the concept of having a nursery maid going in and working for the family and, you know, just having that. And of course, you know, having had the Downton Abbey and knowing everybody wants all the elements of a house now, you know, they want the below the stairs as well as above stairs. And there was a really interesting thing that happened. I'm sure you know about this. The National Trust noticed that after Downton Abbey started, you know, the whole point of National Trust houses for a long time was all the artwork and all the antiques and all the grandeur of the rooms and so on. And after Downton Abbey came out, everybody started saying, we want to see the kitchens, we want to see the servants' quarters, you know, and they had to kind of, those who still have them, not them to have them anymore, but those who did, you know, started opening up all those areas again, because people, you know, quite often could trace their relatives back to probably both upstairs and downstairs, you know. And so you want to see that all of that parts of the house. So I knew I wanted all of that in the house. And so anyway, and the nursery maid is a really good one, because the nursery sits in this funny little spot in a grand house. It's neither upstairs nor downstairs, really, you know, because the nannies were really the ones in charge of the children, sort of more than the mothers were.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And would quite often sort of run their kitchen slightly separately and put in separate orders to the cooks. And so they were often kind of loggerheads with everybody else in the house. But they would be this little place of retreat for the children, hopefully, if they were nice nannies and nice nurseries, you know. Anyway, and then so once I kind of got that going, I thought, yeah, this is something that could, you know, really work. And then we gave nursery maid Louisa somebody who was a boyfriend or sweet potential boyfriend who's in the police. And then actually Ed found this real life unsolved murder of Florence Nightingale. And once we had that, and I discovered that Florence Nightingale, who was the goddaughter of the real Florence Nightingale, but she was a war nurse as well, albeit in the First World Boer War, First World War. But she was getting a train to see her sister, who lived in the same seaside town that the Mitford's nanny used to go to and used to take them to. So I was like, amazing, you know, a genuine unsolved murder. And a connection that I can make happen with the Mitfords, and so that was it.
I thought it was fascinating. When I read it, I loved the fact that you had a real life unsolved murder. I thought, what a gem to discover.
Yeah, no, it was.
How did you feel when you were writing it? Did you feel like, I'm going to get to the bottom of this? I've got to find out what happened. Did you start becoming obsessed with it?
I wanted to. I mean, I'm convinced that I did come up with the solution. It's quite difficult because all the records were destroyed in the 1960s, so that you. But I mean, they really never did solve it, and there aren't really a lot of decent clues still left out there. And what I really liked was the kind of the inversion of it in a funny way was, you know, before with Downton Abbey books, I was taking fictional characters and looking at, you know, the inspiration that Julian had taken in real life. So there were lots of kind of storylines that stemmed from events that were happening in the world at that time. So one of my favourites, for example, was Lady Edith, who's one of the daughters in the show. For those who, not everyone would have seen it, she has an illegitimate baby who she gives up for adoption, essentially, to the farmer's wife, and then takes her back. Now, this is what happened was, after the First World War, there was a rise in illegitimacy for obvious reasons, with sort of soldiers kind of coming home and everyone giving them one last dance before they went back to near certain death.
Yeah.
And so, obviously that would, if you were, not only if you were a mother of someone who was illegitimate, but as an illegitimate child yourself, you had very little hope in the future in terms of getting married well, or even getting a decent job, or, you know, life was going to be very, very difficult for you. So the best thing that your mother could do for you was to give you away to a family. And sort of weirdly, when the family took in an illegitimate child, that stain of illegitimacy was sort of magically erased, and that child would be, even if everybody knew they'd been taken in, they were protected by this family, and they would sort of be okay. What happened after the First World War was just the mothers were given their babies away, and then a few years later, older, they would maybe marry, you know, and somebody else, and they went to get their babies back. And the people who had adopted them, who'd been looking after them since they were babies and loved them and had them as one of the family, had absolutely no legal recourse to prevent this from happening. So it was a really heartbreaking time. It's one of my favourite scenes in Downton Abbey is when Lady Edith takes her baby daughter back from the farmer's wife who's been looking after her, because you just don't know whose side to be on. You know, should this baby be with her real mother, or should she be with the woman who's been loving her like one of her own, you know, for years? And so that was why that was why adoption became a legal process in 1926.
Right.
So it was really, you know, there was a really interesting way of kind of sort of substantiating a lot of what Julian wrote in the show, making it really kind of real.
Yeah.
History knowledge is brilliant. So that was taking a fictional character and finding out the real life thing behind it. And then with Mitford Murders, it's this kind of weird mix where on the one hand, I've got these real characters, the real life Florence Nightingale who gets married and gets murdered, and then the real life Mitford sisters and all the people around them. And I'm putting them into fictional situations and trying to work out, you know, how they would behave. And at first I really struggled with it because my comfort zone was very much nonfiction. Mm-hmm. The fact that I could just research something and find out a fact. And I can remember I had a soldier character in the first book, and I thought to myself at one point, oh, it's so annoying that I can't just look up what rank he was in the army, you know. And I was like, oh, I can just make it up. But I was trying to sort of underpin a lot of what happened in the novel on sort of real life events, because in some ways it's a bit of a cheat because it's a shortcut to authenticity. But also it made me feel more comfortable. But the other thing I did find interesting was just trying to work out those Mitford sisters' characters. And I sort of, in the end, I sort of worked out for myself that, first of all, there's no such thing as a single true version of something that happened in the past. There's no one, you know, there's no one version of it.
No.
It's your version, there's everybody else's version. You know, you can test this out by just asking five people what happened at Christmas Day last year, you know, and they'll all give you a slightly different story. So I thought, it's legitimate to look at a historical event from another angle. The other, you know, and the Mitford sisters themselves did not always agree on what their childhood was like or what their parents were like or what each other was like or what was, you know, happening in the 1920s, and sometimes down to some quite basic facts, you know, about what childhood illness they had would be recorded differently by the sisters. And I thought, in a way, what's really nice, I'm not trying to write a biography, I'm trying to look at the gaps in between the facts that we know. And, you know, what might have happened that took them from there to there. And that allows your imagination to sort of run free. And then also I had my fictional characters there to kind of help them along the way. But it's been really, over six books, I became much more confident about sort of putting more onto them, and they became more real. So Nancy, who I've worked with across six books, feels incredibly real to me now, even though most of it's probably superimposed by me.
But I guess it's a bit like writing a biography. You've done so much research into them. You know them intimately. You feel as if they're, you know, a part of your life.
Yeah, no, you do. But at the same time, you can't write a biography. You know, it is a very different thing. And I'm never happier than when a reader says, I read one of your novels and that made me go off and read a Mitford novel, or, you know, Laura Thompson's book about them, or, you know, something like that. That's great. You know, people have gone in to find out more for themselves. But what I've tried to do is put in detail that the Mitford fan would recognise. You know, I think everybody likes to be made to feel a bit clever.
Yeah.
And if there's a small detail that you know and you recognise in the novel, I think that's quite fun. But if you don't know them, it doesn't matter at all.
That's very good. I like that idea. So you knew always there would be six books because there are six sisters. You've not been tempted to say, oh, I'm going to add some extra books in now.
Well, they are now asking about extra books. So we'll see. I mean, we hoped it would be six. I mean, the contracts were always two at a time because... Mm-hmm. You know, if they failed completely, then they wouldn't. But they were a big success. And what was really surprising was that the rights sold really well all over the world. Just I think 18 different territories, I think, and they've been a big hit in funny places, surprising places like Finland and Italy. And you know, I just why are they interested in this crazy bunch of poshos? You know, before the war makes me nuts. So we knew that would be six, but there's a sort of bit of talk at the moment about. I mean, I have to admit, when I finished the last one, which is out in November, it was actually a really nice one to do as well, because it was with Deborah, who was kind of one of the more sane, nice ones of the sisters, and having done all the Nazis and the fascists and the communists, and you know, gets pretty dark at times, I decided for the last one, you know, we just have, we all need a bit of nice, fun escapism after everything we've all been through, you know, and having got through those difficult sisters. So it's all set in Chatsworth, and, you know, it's all kind of, you know, there's still a murder or two, obviously, but. But anyway, I did think, oh, it would be really quite sad not to. But I really enjoy writing Nancy now.
Yes.
Now I know her so well. And that's what becomes really fun. When you really know a character well, you can drop them into any situation, and then you've got much better instinct for how they're going to react. You know, the hardest bit about fiction is writing truthfully, you know, writing it in a non-fiction way almost, you know, just making sure that your character is reacting and responding in a way that is genuinely true to them and not just useful to you because you've decided that's the way your plot's going to go.
Yeah.
And that, you know, that's why you get writers saying, oh, just so annoying, you know, they won't do what I want yeah. them to do. And that's what they mean, you know, and it's also sort of why I think the more novels you write, I mean, every writer is different in terms of how much they plot and plan ahead, but I definitely plot much less. It's, you know, it's trickier with crime because you do have to work certain things out, but what I prefer to do now is a sort of bridging thing, so I sort of know where everybody starts, I know where everybody's going to end up and roughly what happens in the middle, but I don't know exactly how
you're going to get there.
And also it makes it more fun. You know, so writing, and then Peter comes into the room. Oh, does Peter come into the room? Brilliant. It's going to happen now. It's amazing how you are. I mean, it's really like being a child. You know, I'm sitting in a room making stuff up, basically. It's
fantastic.
Yeah.
And you've got, obviously, those six books. You've got the sixth one coming out soon. And now you've got another departure. So you went from non-fiction to crime fiction. Mm. And now you've got a standalone novel. Is it going to be a standalone?
It is a standalone. I mean, that was a funny one. So basically that initiated originally with an Italian publisher called Mondadori, and they had approached me a few times over the years to write something. And I kept saying, I can't do more than I'm doing. And then the last offer was just when the lockdowns were coming. And I thought, well, if the world is going to go to pieces and I'm going to sit in my room and write, and then I might as well just write loads, you know. So, and they said, we just want a novella, so like half length, and you know, really can be about anything you want, and you know, maybe you've got something in your bottom drawer anyway. So I thought, oh well, actually I do have that novel that I started trying to write a few years ago, just before the Mitford murders. I sort of vaguely looked at the document, like I've got about 20,000 words. I thought, okay, great. And I had about 6 weeks for the deadline. I just couldn't get to it before that because I was finishing another Mitford book and I was doing a television script that year as well. And anyway, so I got it out and I was like, brilliant, okay, I'll start now a new book and I'll read what I've done so far. That's
it. Yeah.
Really bad. Really bad. It's just not publishable. So I thought, well, okay, now I've got not very long to write a novella. But I thought, well, at least my writing's improved in the last few years because I can see that it's not good. But I just took the kernel of the idea from it, which was this relationship between two women. And that, you know, it's the main character, Kate, is, you know, kind of started not being my grandmother, but I took a lot of her characteristics from my grandmother. It always sort of slightly fascinated me in my mind in terms of who she was and how she got to be the way that she was. And I've always been interested in the whole nature of female friendship, you know, how intense it is, how much it means to women, how little girls get schooled in that language of relationships, the sort of desire to find the one, the absolute best friend, and what that really means. And then also having watched long friendships sort of over time. My mother died when I was about 30, but I inherited her best friend, and who became mine. And we you know, just like she would tell me about her other friendships that were going on, female friendships, how they changed, you know, over time, how people's characteristics changed, how that means they evolve together. So I just thought I really want to hone in on that. And so that so it became this book about two women from 6 to 82 and sort of key junctures that they come together. And what that does, you know, just, you know, what that kind of friendship starts to mean after a long period of time, even if one of you's behaved really badly in the middle of that. So that was, you know, so what it came. So it was, and then my UK and my US publishers very nicely said that they wanted to buy it and publish it as well. So I had no real sort of plans for it beyond that. I'm going to New York next week to launch it in America, and they've had a kind of slightly different response to it, which has been really interesting. Much more
what
sort
way?
Of younger, yeah, but sort of younger girls, and talking about it, and you know, talking about their friendships and so on. But it's written in a very different way, slightly experimental way, because I thought, well, you know, I'm never going to get this opportunity to just write what I really want to write and have a go at doing something very different. I think partly because I've been doing the television script. I was really enjoying writing dialogue. Mm-hmm. And then also I've read Girl, Woman, Other by Bernardine Evaristo, which I loved. And I really loved her use. Not that it would work for every book, but just for her book, she has no full stops except at the very end of each chapter. And it means it takes a while in a way to get into it. But for me, it meant the prose read almost like poetry. She gave it a real rhythm and a flow that I thought was really interesting. And so I had this idea of doing the dialogue in The Best Friend without any speech marks or he said, she said, and you have to, you know, so you start, it's only ever between two women and the voices should be distinct enough. You start to have to sort of follow. But the idea is that you're completely immersed in their conversation, because for them, when it's the two of them talking, that's what it's about. It's just them and their conversation. None of the rest of it matters. And I like the idea of not setting it in any particular time or any particular place. There's very little physical description. I like the readers to impose their own pictures on them. And it's because my books have been so much about the period they're in, the place they're in, you know, kind of what they're wearing, it was just really interesting to just strip all that away and just get just down to the kind of raw nuances of a female friendship. And it's only about them, you know, the other characters are kind of peripheral in the sense that they're only there to show when the women are reacting against them in some way, you know, and into each other. So it was an experiment.
As we've got a question here, and do remember everybody, you can put a question for Jessica in the chat. When you're writing dialogue, do you ever trial it by reading it out with others?
No, you know, I know everybody always says that you should do that. And I did think about it at one point, and maybe if I'd given myself longer to write it, it would have been interesting to do that. It is a very good idea to do it with dialogue. I find it, and I know Julian reads that dialogue for his scripts to himself. Mm-hmm. There's a sort of cringe factor that's quite hard to get over. And also I'm very impatient. So when you read stuff out loud, you know, it's slow. I'm very admiring of Anne Tyler because she reads out every single word and then listens to it and then edits, you know, and I say, oh my God, that's hours and hours and hours. But then she writes.
She writes amazing
books. So, you know, maybe I really should be giving it a go. I did work when we had the audiobook recorded. It was really quite fun because we got two different actresses to do it, and it should read a bit like, you know, listen a bit like a radio play. They put in sound so you can tell when they're talking on the telephone and that sort of thing. So it's a bit one up from a normal audiobook.
Yeah. We've also got a question, it's quite a long question, about deafness. Gita says, I saw an interesting programme about John Bishop and his son Joe. Joe has an autoimmune disease and was 15 when he started to lose his hearing. He's lost 60% of his hearing. In the documentary, John and Joe learn BSL and John performed a gig in sign language with deaf comedians. The programme was called John and Joe Bishop Life After Deaf. Joe found a really welcoming deaf community as he'd fallen into a void where he felt he didn't fit in anymore. How old were you when you started to lose your hearing, and how did it affect your life? Did you find solace in writing as well as in reading?
Well, thank you very much for that thoughtful question. No, funny enough, I was reading about that documentary this morning, so I'm definitely going to watch it. Well, I was born deaf. They didn't know until I was 2.5, because I was born in 1974, and they didn't have all the hearing tests that you have now. So it was only when I was apparently being very naughty and ignoring my mother in the park, and that sort of thing, they realised. So I was 2.5 when I was diagnosed. And that was just enough time for my parents to be able to work on my speech early on. And my mother was an actress, so she used to do elocution exercises with me all the time. And they would talk to me like this, so that I would hear every, you know, syllable of a sound. So I think, you know, in those days, in the 70s, it was a sort of funny thing, because it was actually, the trend was for sending children to special needs schools. And my mother really fought against it. I think I did do one day in a deaf school, and she said that that's enough. She's going to normal schools. And so she went, you know, my parents definitely, for them, it was like, it's about treating it as if it doesn't really exist, and we're just going to carry on life normally. So they gave me huge confidence. There was an element, I think, possibly of never really addressing the fact that it was something that I found difficult and embarrassing at times. But, you know, but the general MO was, you know, we're just going to kind of carry on. So I never got involved in any sort of deaf community and had very few deaf friends, one or two. And actually now, when I do meet people who are deaf, it's funny, there's a part of me that enjoys being able to talk about stuff and recognise things and laugh about certain things, but it's another part of me that doesn't want to be identified. You know, it's like, it is a part of my identity, but it isn't all front and centre of who...
It doesn't define me.
I'm very lucky compared to most deaf people, you know.
Yeah.
I can hear, engage in normal life without, you know, really too many bells and whistles.
And you perform on stage, and you give talks about your books, and and I've posted everybody in the chat. Jessica wrote a wonderful article a little while ago when Rose Ailing Ellis was on Strictly as its first deaf contestant.
Oh, yeah. So
I'll put that up for you. And there's this fabulous photo of you in the dancing, and kind of, you know, really freaking out on the dance floor. And it's
a
picture. So everybody, particularly the Strictly fans out there, do have a look at that article. I think it was really wonderful. I'm just briefly going to tell everybody what's coming up, Jessica, and then we're going to come back to you. And I think we should talk about publishing and your impressions of publishing. So everybody, coming up on the book club next week on Thursday, I'm going to be talking to Andrew Eames, who is a travel writer. We're obviously coming to the end of our Agatha Christie month. And Andrew Eames wrote a really fascinating book called The 855 to Baghdad, about a train journey that he did following in the footsteps of Agatha Christie, or the train steps, I should say, from kind of Surrey all the way to Baghdad. It's such an interesting book, and I read it years ago and I've never forgotten it. So I was really pleased to get him to come on. And then on the 30th of September, we're back with Book of the Month. And of course, this month it's Agatha Christie's Appointment with Death. So please do read it and come along and chat next Friday. The following week, the 6th of October, we've got Adam Williams, our lovely producer, who is going to be interviewing Margaret Willis. And she is the author of In the Shadow of St. Paul's Cathedral. Really fascinating book, really interesting about the history of that whole area. And then the following day, on the 7th of October, and in fact, I've got it here. I wasn't very prepared this morning, but I do have one of my books here. I'm going to be interviewing Richard Hammond. Now, you might think, oh, the guy from Top Gear. No, not that Richard. he's an author, and this is his latest book, The Green Traveller. And he's really made his mission to let us all see about holidays that don't cross the earth, about traveling by train instead of by plane, and looking at places where you can go wild swimming around the UK. Very, very interesting. So do join us for that. And then also to let you know what is coming up on PPG, our sister show, Purpose, Passion, Grit, which is on, as you know, on a Tuesday lunchtime. So next Tuesday, on the 27th of September, we have Humphrey talking to Jeff Spink, who is a champion of thalidomide sufferers, who's worked as the age and disability correspondent for BBC News, reporting for radio, television and the BBC website. And then we have a special on the 4th of October. Adam Williams is back interviewing our own Rosie Stancer, the wonderful Rosie, and her entire team, who are crossing the Sinai Desert at the moment. They're going to tell us about their roles in the team, their training and their hopes and fears. They're about to set off on this incredible exploration. And then on the 11th of October, I'll be back talking to Denise McGahn, who is a life coach with an MSc in applied positive psychology. And she's got a new book out called Anthology, which offers an alternative perspective on midlife, how you can create a future full of meaning and fulfillment. Couldn't be more of a Goldster subject, could it? So really, really looking forward to all of that. And as you know, we've got some really fascinating people coming up. But Jessica, you have been absolutely brilliant. And I'd love you to tell us about what you've got. Crime, capital crime coming up, haven't you, next week on the 30th?
Yeah, and I think there's still tickets. And I'm on an amazing panel with Abir Mukherjee, who's done some historical crime books set in India. And a couple of other crime authors, we're talking about kind of about using history in crime books. Capital crime in basketball.
Long overdue to start having literary festivals in London, because it's so bizarre how many there are around the rest of the country, and very few. There was a time when there was almost nothing in London. Festivals have become a big thing, haven't they? And to have
capital. As an author, you know this, Lucinda. You know, you spend so much time sitting by yourself at your desk, and you kind of almost forget that anybody's going to read the books. And so it's really nice not only to meet other writers and sort of swap war stories with them, but also to meet, you know, real life people who've been reading your books. It's always quite exciting.
So you've been in publishing now, really, quite including magazine publishing since you left university.
Yeah.
Have you noticed a change in publishing? I mean, how do you feel? Because I've definitely noticed a change in publishing over the times. I started out as an editor and then became an author. What do you think it's like now in publishing? Is it different from when you were first working in it?
Well, magazine publishing, you know, I've kind of been out of that game for a while. Funny, recently I've been feeling like I'd love to get, I think it's because I've started reading interiors magazines again, and I've been thinking, oh, it'd be really nice to sort of get into that. I think that, you know, newspaper publishing is a very different game from when I was in it, because they're under a lot of pressure with not a lot of money to produce a lot of content. And so I think, you know, people are getting stretched very thin, and then they are spending less money where I think it really matters, like really good sub-editors. And journalists now have to write their own headlines, and they get, and headline writing is a real skill. It's difficult.
Oh, yeah. I find it so hard to write headlines.
So hard to write headlines. You know, some people are natural at it.
Yeah.
But of course, what happens is they get, tracked according to how many clicks their articles are getting. And so this is why you get this clickbait territory. Mm-hmm. And I had it a few times myself at the Mail on Sunday, where you write a fairly innocent interview, but the subs would find something that they could turn into a headline, and you would think, oh my god, that's not the article that I was writing. So that was the Mail on Sunday, you know, thing. But, you know, getting journalists to do that themselves on their own articles is, you know, it's quite dangerous, I think. Mm-hmm. There's been that element has changed. In book publishing, it's hard. I mean, I've been in book publishing really only since 2010. I think, you know, definitely the biggest changes have probably just been in the last very few years, just because of the pandemic and the lockdown. And what the biggest effect, really, I think, that happened was that books were still selling because people were reading, but people weren't able to go to bookshops. And so they were buying off your well-known online bookshops instead. And what happened was that they would, you know, you're not browsing, you're not talking to the book assistant, you're not picking up that book by chance. You're reading the books that are being recommended to you according to your algorithm. So all the big authors, your Dan Browns and your J.K. Rowlings and Robert Galbraith or whatever, you know, the big authors are doing amazingly well. They're selling huge numbers. I mean, Richard Osman's books, he's selling huge numbers. but it's really hard for your mid-level author and your, especially your debut author, to find a way to get your head above the parapet and to get noticed and to get promoted online. And the publishers themselves have, you know, been putting more and more resource into this big stuff. So they spend their money on supermarket promotions, although supermarkets are not buying as much as they were.
Interesting.
You know, into online promotions or major bookstore promotions. They are very supportive of independent bookshops because they do recognise now what a difference an independent bookshop can make to an author. And they, you know, you can get, still shift a lot of books through independent bookshop. And they seem to be thriving. They're doing really well. Bookshops and toy stores, apparently.
Oh, really?
Well, because we all want to go in and touch and feel them. And millennials want books that, you know, want to physically pick up a book. They want the artwork. You know, it's only old geezers like me who like Kindles because of the backlight and the increasing fonts. You know, but ebooks have flatlined, you know, so there is really a market out there. But what's difficult is they're not putting the resource into promoting the book. So I've been very lucky with the Mickford Murders, you know, that partly because it was the publisher's idea and it was a book that was, you know, sold really well from the beginning, but it was much harder to promote The Best Friend. And you know, to write that as a standalone, it was an unexpected book. It wasn't something that, you know, I'd written before. And they just, you know, it really had to come down to me to do more. I'm going to do more when the paperback comes out in February. In some ways, it doesn't really matter because it is a very experimental book. It's probably not written in a format that I'll repeat again, but it's been really interesting to see what a difference it makes. And the advice I would always give to any author is you have to do whatever the publisher says they're going to do, that's fine. But treat your book as if they were going to do nothing. Do as much as you possibly can to promote the book. Do it yourself. Go into the bookshop, knock on the door, ask to sign
your own publicity. Yeah.
Around those literary festivals, are you looking for a panelist? Are you looking for a chair? Have you thought about this for an idea? Absolutely. You know, it's just be shameless, and it's the only way.
No, I agree totally. It's deeply frustrating. I know we have lots of authors who say the same thing, that the publicity side is, you know, it's really hard. So we've got to.
You know, you're the one who's earning the money from the book, so go out and sell them. And nobody loves your book,
Knows it like you do. Absolutely,
nobody knows it like
a you comment
do.
Here. I totally agree. That's how I got my book stocked. Yeah, and we've also got a comment. I love the smell of new books. There is nothing. There. Nothing like that smell of new books, or maybe the smell of old books.
Very old, but I know, and eyeing up your lovely button leather-bound books behind you.
Yes, my parents' books, and yes, they are all. Those are actually in cloth, and they're that beautiful feeling of old cloth.
I know. I still worry about those books.
They're actually rather gorgeous.
Will they ever get read again? Those books. That's what I find. They become kind of furniture. Accessories, you know.
They're just very, very heavy to lift up. Yeah. But they do feel, I love that feeling of the material books that have that gold lettering on.
Yeah,
just beautiful. Yeah, so that smell is really wonderful. So thank you so much, Jessica. It's been a real joy. I've been wanting to get you on for ages. And then I thought, we're doing an Agatha Christie month. I know a crime to get on. So thank you so much for joining us today. And good luck with The Best Friend, and good luck with the upcoming final. Or not, Murder's book, the sixth, I should say, not necessarily
the final, the sixth one,
and with everything else, and have a bit of time off and let your brain just. I bet you one day your brain will go, I want to do this, and you'll be really glad you had that.
I know, exactly. Can't wait. Oh, thank you so much. Really good fun.
And thank you everyone for coming along. And Jessica and I are going to turn off our videos now, and Joe will end the meeting. But I will see you next week, and have a great weekend, everyone. Bye. Thank you for listening to this Goldster podcast, where we aim to bring you great interviews, to expand your world, and to keep you curious. Please look us up at www.goldster.co.uk, and don't forget to subscribe to the podcast.